science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
My mum doesn't like this thing, and Ellen's still laughing about the last ad.
If you don't like heard that before, that's brilliant.
Broadcast. It's brilliant. Hey, Ellen, how's it going?
Hey, Will, it's going very well. It's the end of the academic year. Lectures are finished. Labs are finished. All the wee kiddies are having their exams and stuff next week, so...
For AUT. It's a bit not
a,
for Auckland.
Not for Auckland. Okay, well, it's a bit of a lull, shall we say, in which time one can get some productive work done. It's also the theory goes anyway, but in practice it never works like that, sadly. Where do the hours go? I don't
Where
know.
Do the hours go?
Indeed.
That's what we're talking... No, we're not talking about that today. Item one for today. The first one up is New Zealand songbird attacks other males. What?
Indeed.
So we have a topical story, for, like, you know, because we've got Bird of the Year going around at the moment. Well, yeah. It's already happened. Do you know who won?
No, I don't know who won.
The Kier won.
The Kier.
I think.
Wow. I remember when it was the Grey Warbler one year. Good things, Grey Warblers.
Well, the first story we have is about the Tui attacking other males if the other male's song is better than theirs. A little bit of Tui jealousy.
Yeah, indeed. So this is research done out of Massey University. And so, as you say, Tui's sing wonderfully. Anybody who's got any sort of trees in the backyard and stuff and hears the Tui in the morning, they're fantastic. They apparently can do at least 56 separate syllables, apparently.
Syllables?
Syllables, sort of different noises, I guess.
Yeah.
And they're very, very good at mimicking as well. So they do sort of cell phones and car alarms and things, apparently, which I didn't know.
Yeah, I've never heard that before.
Yeah, yep. So they're also very good mimics. But apparently, according to this latest research out of Massey, the story is that if you are a Tui and you're the best singer on the block, then you are going to arouse the wrath of your male neighbours, seemingly, because you're a threat to them. And they're scared that you're going to get the girl, as it were. So the
because I know from experience, Tui's can be dicks. Not all of them are. I'm not judging Tui's by any means, but I've seen them attack sparrows and all sorts of other
yeah.
Birds.
No, well this is them going for other Tui's. So it's the males, of course. It's always the males. Yep. And so this was just published in the IBIS International Journal of Avian Science this month. And so basically the findings are that the males who sing the best appear to arouse aggressive behaviour in other males. And the way that they did this was to take recordings of Tui's and Tui's singing very, very complex songs and very, very simple songs, okay? And so the theory was that the Tui's who sing the more complex songs, the females are going to go for them because being able to sing a complex song is a sign of health.
And so
they went up to Te Whanganui, where actually I went camping over Labor weekend. So it's very nice up there.
See any Tui's?
Lots, yes, yeah, fantastic. Lots. Oh, baby poo kickers, my goodness, they are just the cutest thing. My goodness.
Let's not even get started.
No, we won't. Anyway, so they basically set up some speakers and stuff up in the Te Whanganui up there, lots of Tui's around, and they would play these recordings of complex songs and simple songs, and within the sort of the region of a particular male Tui. And what they found was that when they played the complex songs, the male Tui's would actually come up and sort of get very, very close to the speakers and start acting very aggressively towards them and start warbling themselves and trying to sort of outsing these things. So they'd come up to around about 30 centimetres away from the speakers, whereas the average distance when they were playing the less complex song, the simple songs, that was about 6 metres or so. So they really really didn't give a toss with the simple songs.
So they'd check it out, but they wouldn't really care.
Yeah, so they didn't sort of see it as a threat, presumably. But when they hear this complex song, they think, uh-oh, you know, this guy's out on the block. He's gonna get my girl. I better do something about it. And so they start behaving all aggressively. So
that's so interesting. Because I'm from Wellington. I lived quite near the Karori Wildlife Sanctuary.
Yeah.
And my mum would go mad because there was these crazy Tui's that would love up a hurrikau tree and they'd just, you know, blitz out their song. Sometimes it'd be crazy. It'd just be screeching and just all the, you know. Maybe just the louder and screechier it is, the more females you attract.
Yeah, kind of like karaoke, really. Sort of Tui karaoke, you know, whoever's the best singer, you know, at the end of the night, so to speak.
I think it's the most energetic singer that counts for karaoke, Alan. It's not necessarily the best.
Yeah, could be, yeah.
Anyway, for our second story, we've got a study that proves dogs can smell our emotions.
Yeah, yeah.
That, I can't tell if that's adorable or kind of scary.
Well, bit of both, probably. Again, so it's a recent study in the journal Animal Cognition. And this is kind of clever, because what they found was that, as you say, that animals can basically smell our emotions. They can smell fear. You know, you're always told as a kid that, you know, if you see this dog on the other side of the road, you know, don't be scared because they can smell it. Well, it's true, seemingly. Mm. Now, what they had to do in this study was to take away the visual cues.
Okay.
And just purely use the olfactory cues, if you were. So obviously, you know, if a dog and his owner, you know, if the owner is sort of showing fear visually, then the dog will do the same sort of thing. But how do you just sort of get it down to smells? Well, what they did, and this is really clever, was that they got 40 male dog owners, and this was research carried out by a group in Italy and in Portugal. Mm-hmm. And they took these 40 male dog owners and they made them watch two movies. Number one, The Jungle Book, mm-hmm. and number two, The Shining.
Fantastic.
And then after they'd been watching those movies, they took sweat samples off them. So okay. after they'd been watching The Jungle Book, they'd have happy sweat. And after they've been watching The Shining...
Happy sweat,
yes, indeed,
Alan.
Indeed. Happy sweat and scary sweat.
My question here is at this point, is how does fear have a smell? Is it like a pheromone
have you,
thing?
Have you never heard of pheromones? There we go. Yes.
No, apparently.
Apparently.
I mean, it must be so it's small and so intricate. I mean, they always talk about how humans can detect other humans, but we just don't know that we're detecting it.
Yeah, apparently. So, you know, we do give off odors that reflect our moods.
Yeah.
So
that's why I smell so bad right now.
So anyway, they would take these sweat samples from after watching The Jungle Book and The Shining, which is scary. And then what they would do, would get a room and they would place the dog in with its owner in this room with a stranger. Okay.
Okay.
And they'd let them sort of get acquainted and everything, and their heart rate monitor on the dog and blah, 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 blah. And then, after everyone sort of got acquainted, then they would bring in a sample of this sweat. Okay,
yeah.
It's either the happy sweat or the scary sweat or the control with okay. nothing. Then they'd stick that in the middle of the room. Mm. And then the dog owner and the stranger would then sit there reading a newspaper. Okay, so they'd ignore the dog completely.
Okay.
Okay. And then the dog was free to roam around and it could smell this... smell.
Yeah.
And they, as I said, they got the heart rate monitor on it. What they found was that when they used a scary sweat, that the heart rate of the dog was on average higher than average.
Okay.
Okay. And also that the dog would stick closer to its owner. That it wouldn't go anywhere near the stranger.
I was wondering why they had the stranger in there as well.
Yeah. And so you see the exact opposite. So when they've got the happy sweat, the Jungle Book sweat, then the dog would become a lot more inquisitive. It would go and sniff around the stranger, et cetera, et cetera. And it wouldn't stick so close to its owner. The heart rate was down. And so basically the people in there weren't providing any visual clues for the dog. So they then say that any of the dog's behavior now becomes entirely based on the smell. Okay, so the odors that the dog is smelling. And it is kind of clever. I think that was a nicely thought out experiment. They did well there.
I mean, it's simple and it's effective.
Yes.
Which is
yep.
good science.
No, absolutely it is. It's good science, yes.
That's interesting about the stranger, because the dog must think, oh, my owner is happy, therefore this person is not a threat, therefore I can check them out.
Yes.
Whereas if it was fear, then it was like, who is this person?
Yeah.
My question is... And you might not know the answer.
You've always got a question.
I always have a question. You should be used to it by now. Is why all male owners?
I don't know. I really don't.
Surely that skews the whole thing a little bit.
Maybe males and females give out different odors. Possibly. I don't know. And they were very selective with their dogs as well. It had to be golden retrievers or labs.
Oh, okay. Well. So, definitely more to be done there, I feel.
Yeah.
I mean,
always the case with science. There's always more work to be done. So, you know, the next paper is going to be the women owners.
They've got to compare it to something that's similar. I mean, it would be interesting if there was a pit bull study or something, because that would be good. That would be amazing to study.
Actually, yeah. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Because,
yes.
I mean, as a social aspect as well, there's a lot of critique and discussion around owning pit bulls and things like that.
I'm sure it's on their radar. I think, yeah. No, that's a very sensible follow-up, I would say. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Thanks, Alan. I'm an aspiring scientist on the moon.
Put in some grant money. Come on.
Oh, fantastic.
To it.
I like dogs, so it's going to work out. The last story we have today is maybe a bit controversial and pretty sad, if I'm honest.
Yep.
A researcher from the University of British Columbia has admitted to falsifying evidence that attributed aluminium in vaccines to autism in lab mice, and the lab mice they were testing. Two questions. Mm-hmm. What are the implications of a study that's been published that had falsified information in it? And why would you do this?
Well, okay, so long story short, it's another paper that's basically, as you say, linking vaccines to autism. Okay. And as soon as it was published, of course, Twitter just went mad and all these people saying, oh yes, here's a direct link and it's been proven and blah de blah de blah de blah de blah. And the way that a lot of this works is that these papers are made public in preprints before they actually get published, and it gives people the opportunity to have a look at these papers and in quite some detail. And obviously a controversial paper like this is going to be looked at in a lot of detail.
Yeah.
And what was found was basically some of the figures in the paper had either been reused or had been altered in order to fit the thesis of the paper. And the sad thing is that this is not the first time that these two authors have had to have a paper retracted. Now, if you're a scientist, the worst thing that can happen to you is getting a paper retracted.
Two times, though.
The world record for paper retractions is around about, I think, 180.
What?
Yeah, I know.
How are these people still allowed to
I haven't even published 180 bloody papers. So,
you know. How many have you published, Alan?
Oh, getting on for 190-something, I think.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Far out.
Oh, no, honestly, I kid you not. No, it's not an enormous number, but so you know, basically, if you have a paper retracted, that's the scientific literature saying no, this paper is not good enough. You have betrayed your scientific principles. You have committed fraud. That sort of thing. That's why papers get retracted.
So this was up there. People could read this and believe it as true.
Yes.
And then it was only retracted recently, is that right?
Yes. Well, it was published, I think, last month, September, and now it's being retracted. Okay. Now, the author, the lead author is an ophthalmologist. Okay. Now, that should sort of set the alarm bells ringing.
What is that?
An ophthalmologist, somebody who does the eyes, okay?
Okay.
Like an optometrist, so a medical optometrist sort of thing. So
okay.
You kind of got to question why an ophthalmologist would be studying vaccines,
for starters.
You know, that's not your job.
Mm.
That's not really what you do. And the second thing is that the journal it was published in is a thing called the Journal of Inorganic Biochemistry. And that's about as far away from ophthalmology as you can get, number one. And number two, if this paper really were as groundbreaking and as totally truthful as it purported to be, then it would have been published in Nature or The Lancet or the British Medical Journal or the New England Journal of Medicine or whatever, your top journals. Now, perhaps the general public don't realise that the mere fact that something gets published doesn't really attest to its veracity, because there is a ranking of journals out there. There's your very, very good ones, and there's your, I'm not going to call them shit ones, but, you know, the less good ones, shall we say.
Yes.
Now, groundbreaking, truly amazing science get published in the best journals. Sadly, some crap also gets published in the best journals, but not very much, okay? You can pretty much hang your hat on whatever gets published in the best journals is pretty true. So the fact that this was published in a much lesser journal should have sort of led to alarm bells ringing, but no, Twitter just said, oh, you know, here's a link, it's been published, it must be true. Sadly, that's not the case necessarily.
Yeah, and the worrying thing is social media snaps these things up straight away. So even though you say it's been taken down or it's been proven to be false,
yep,
the media still grab hold of it, and then not many people are going to snatch on, you know.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's the initial paper that makes the news. It's not the retraction, sadly, that makes the news. So there are a dedicated couple of scientists who run a blog called Retraction Watch, which keeps a record of all scientific papers that have been retracted. And that's a big bloody job, that is, sadly, these days. It really
is. Double ups as well.
There's all sorts of ways that people get their papers retracted. And it's just, it really is kind of depressing to realise that it's so prevalent these days. Obviously, it's the publish or perish atmosphere in academia that has come to the fore in the last sort of 10, 20 years. If you're not publishing, then you're not getting grant money, then your job's in danger and blah, blah, blah. So you'll just publish anything and you'll hope like hell it doesn't get spotted. And they were trying to sort of explain this away by saying that they hadn't looked at the original data before they published the paper, and now the data is locked up in China, apparently. Locked up. They can't get at it, apparently, the original data. So it's not good.
It's mind-blowing to me. The fact, especially around vaccines as well, that you'd... I mean, I'm not going to get into the debate here, but to falsify information about something that affects so many people's lives and so many children's lives, and knowingly falsifying this information, knowing that you might actually... It might end in someone's kid dying of measles or something.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. I 1,000% agree with you. I can see that you're very passionate about this, and so am I. I think it's utterly appalling, and those people who do this sort of thing are just lower than low.
And is there law around this? I mean, can these people be...
Well, what you do find is that, you know, if falsification is proven, then these people can lose their jobs, certainly, yes. Yes, that does happen.
Okay.
That
but there's does no happen. Criminal...
Criminal, yes, there can be as well. In fact, if you're taking, certainly in the States, if you're taking federal funds... to do research and you're not doing the research that you say you're going to do, or you're falsifying or whatever, then yes, people have ended up in jail for that. So, you know, there are consequences potentially.
Good.
So we'll see what happens with this. Yeah.
I mean, we need safeguards to stop people from making absurd claims.
Absolutely. Amen. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you said you had another story.
Interesting one because, okay. Well, we've got a new government.
We do.
We do. And we're going to plant 100 million trees a year.
That's a lot of trees.
Okay, that is a lot of trees. So I ran a few numbers on this. So 100 million trees, okay? So let's show, so 365 days in a year, okay? So we're going to work 5 days a week because we've got to have the two off. So that's 260 working days a year, give or take one.
Yep.
Okay? So that means that every day we're going to be planting 384,615 trees a day. Okay.
My God.
We're going to be working 8 hours in that day because the law says you can't work any longer than that. So that's 48,076 trees per hour. Okay. Or per minute, 801 trees a minute, or every second, 13.35 trees per second. I'm just saying.
Yeah. And that's not accounting for lunch breaks.
No, that's not accounting for lunch breaks or statutory holidays.
Okay. So. I mean, if you had a lot of workers,
I think we need to talk to Tracy Martin about this next week.
Maybe. I'm trying to work that out. Because, I mean, have you heard of...
You would need a lot of workers. You would.
You would.
Absolutely would.
You really would.
Yes.
Or machines. The machines will take over. Yeah. Plant our trees for us.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. There's the search engine. I mean, listeners might use this as well. Escosia. Do you know about Escosia?
No, I don't know about Escosia.
It's every time you search... You just make a search on, I mean, it's not Google, it's got its own Escosia search bar. It says, it comes up on the top right, it doesn't tell you you planted a tree, but your number goes up. So every time you search, it gives you another number and says you've planted a tree. And I mean, I thought this is kind of, do you plant a tree every time? But I think it's more suggested. I think it's like they're putting this money generated from ad revenue to planting trees.
I see, okay. Well, these are 100 billion new trees a year on top of the trees that are already being planted by people like the Tyndall Foundation and co. So, you know.
Hey, anything's good.
I don't disagree. Yeah. I just think, you know, it's going to take some doing.
It is. As always, as every good thing does.
True.
This might just take a lot more. Anyway, thanks, Alan.
Okay, thanks, Will.
That was Dear Science.